Hello and welcome to Open Book, a podcast by National Records of Scotland, dedicated to preserving the past, recording the present and informing the future. This week, researcher Ruth Boreham tells us about her research into the 1911 census, which was seen by suffragettes and suffragists as an opportunity to protest against a government that refused to grant them the parliamentary vote, despite decades of campaigning. Women were urged to boycott the census by spoiling papers, by refusing to give information, or by avoiding their usual residence, and they did, in towns and cities all over Scotland. Speaking at General Register House earlier this month, Ruth tells us about her most interesting discoveries, including some entertaining stories that reveal both the irreverence and the determination of the women's suffrage movement in Scotland. And so now we step back in time to 1911, an era of political ferment, with the ringing cry in the air, "No vote, no census."
Thank you very much for coming along today.
I've been doing some research into the 1911 census up here in Scotland. There was a lot of work done on the 1911 census down in England because the census was released early down in England. It should be closed for 100 years, but they were able to get access to it in 2009. So an incredible scholar called Jill Liddington helped with Elizabeth Crawford, busily did lots of research. So if you want to find out anything about what happened in England, do have a look at their book, Vanishing for the Vote. But I'm going to ignore England completely, which I think is the best way to do it. We'll concentrate solely on Scotland. And I still have a lot of research to do. And I have to say, I have huge thanks to everyone at NRS, particularly Joss, Veronica and Tristan for all their help. But what I want to do today is tell you a little bit about what's been discovered so far. But first, let me set the scene. For that, we need to go back in time. If this was a TV show, we'd have the wavy lines and the funny music. Back in time, 1832. This is when men in towns who owned or lived on property worth at least £10 a year were given the vote. This is called the Reform Act. Men had been campaigning for the right to vote before this. They did do some militancy as well. And this increased the electorate from 4,500 people to over 65,000 men could now vote. But a population of around 8 million, that's still an awful lot of men who couldn't vote. And of course, no women were allowed to vote at all. And then on the 7th of June 1866, the gentleman on the left, John Stuart Mill, he was MP for Westminster, he became the very first British politician in Parliament to formally take up the cause of women's suffrage. He presented an amendment to the Reform Bill calling for a female franchise based on exactly the same property qualification as men, essentially the same votes for women as for men. The reason I really like to mention him is that he gives me a really good excuse to put the photograph of the lady on the right up. This is a lovely lady called Mary Somerville, and those of you who know me know that I am absolutely obsessed with Mary Somerville. If ever you have any trouble sleeping, I always say contact me, I will tell you about her, and you will be asleep in no trouble. I'm also trying to write a book about her as well. Mary Somerville, scientist, died in 1872. You may recognise her from the £10 RBS note, she's now on there. She was the very first to sign the petition that John Stuart Mill presented to Parliament. This petition had 1,499 names on it, but the amendment was defeated by 196 votes to 73. Undeterred, the following year, John Stuart Mill, he tried to make an amendment to the second Reform Act. This Reform Act gave the vote to around 1 million urban males, and he wanted a very small amendment. All he wanted was the word person to be put in the Reform Act. That would then allow women to be given the vote, but that did not happen. And it's really from 1866-67 that this fight for women's suffrage started. You have lovely ladies like Eliza Wigham, pictured here on the left. She was one of a number of women who set up the Edinburgh National Society for Women's Suffrage in 1878. She was a Quaker. She'd been very against slavery. And a lot of the women around this time, you'd find that they had already been petitioning for lots of different changes as well. You then have a real focus on petitions. The societies that were set up around the country decided petitions were the way to make the government realise that they were wrong. So they sent lots of petitions. Between 1867 and 1876, around 2 million signatures were collected in Scotland alone. And lots of talks were held all over the country, from the borders right up to the Shetland. Then in 1897, you have the formation of the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies, the NUWSS. If you have anything to do with the suffrage movement, you will know that it is nothing but acronyms. So this is your first acronym, NUWSS. The lady on the left, Millicent Fawcett, there was a statue unveiled to her down in London a couple of months ago. So all these societies, and you can see them all marked on the branches of the tree, came together. It was like an umbrella term, the National Union of Women's Suffrage. These are better known as the constitutional suffragists, those who worked within the law to try and bring about change. And this carried on, and they kept putting petitions, and they kept talking to men and saying, oh, we really need the vote. But then one woman in particular got really fed up with nothing changing. And in 1903, this woman on the left, who is probably the face that most people recognise when it comes to the suffrage movement, Emmeline Pankhurst, set up the Women's Social and Political Union, acronym number two, WSPU. And their colours, purple, green and white. I didn't have a white skirt, so I'm wearing black, I'm afraid. They set up WSPU, and this really started to change the way that women protested against the fact they didn't have the vote. For example, 1905, 13th of October, down in Manchester, a big Liberal party was held, and these two ladies went in. On the left, you have Annie Kearney. On the right, you have Christabel Pankhurst, one of Emmeline's daughters. They go into the meeting, and they try and raise the question, what about votes for women? And they get thrown out of the meeting. And they decide to take things a bit further. Christabel was studying law, and she knew how to get arrested. So she spat in the face of a policeman. That's all it took. Immediately he was arresting her. She and Annie were taken to court, and the judge said, right, this is your fine. And they said, we're not going to pay it. He went, no, you need to pay it. No, we're not going to pay it. But if you don't pay it, I have to put you in jail. Yeah, absolutely. So they went into prison. The first time that anybody had used going into prison as a way of generating publicity. The WSPU were masters at propaganda. So we've heard of two acronyms. There's one more that I need to mention. In 1907, a group of the WSPU were growing increasingly alarmed at the way that the WSPU were being run. Emmeline and Christabel Pankhurst were almost like dictators controlling everything in society. But they were also getting concerned about the level of criminality that was being used. So they broke away. Charlotte Despard on the left-hand side here, she broke away and set up the Women's Freedom League, WFL, our third and hopefully last acronym. So you have three groups. You have the suffragists, the constitutionalists, the NUWSS, and then you have the Women's Social Political Union, WSPU, and the WFL. Up here in Scotland in particular, the WFL was a larger group than the WSPU, but quite often you had women who belonged to both groups. And that often happened, that you weren't necessarily just a suffragette. You quite often, particularly up here in Scotland, conversed with women on both sides and were friends with women on both sides and paid your dues to both sides as well. Things went up even further in 1908. April 1908, this was arguably one of the most important developments in the history of the suffrage movement. Our Prime Minister at the time was Camberwell Bannerman. He resigned due to ill health and died soon after. And this gentleman here, and I'm sure at the time many wouldn't have called him a gentleman, but this man here, Asquith, he became Prime Minister, and he had been anti-suffrage for a very, very long time. And he is particularly important up here in Scotland, because although he wasn't Scottish, his constituency was in East Fife. In those days, whenever you had a change in Prime Minister, you then had a number of by-elections as well. One of the by-elections that was being contested was up in Dundee. And you might recognise the gentleman standing up, trying to talk to this lovely group in Dundee, telling them why they should vote for him, Winston Churchill, to be their MP. He'd already tried down in Manchester, failed to get elected down there, many say because of the suffragettes, so he thought he would come up to Dundee. The reason I want to show this photograph is because I am slightly in love with the woman who is standing up on the top left, Mary Maloney. She didn't really like Churchill. She was rather fed up with what he was saying, and she took offence at something he'd said earlier, so she came up to Dundee, and what you can't see, but in her hands, she has a dinner bell. Every time that Churchill opened his mouth to speak, Mary would ring the bell. So Churchill moved on. He went somewhere else and Mary followed him. Every time he opened his mouth, she was there ringing the bell. The press, of course, loved this, nicknamed her Belle Maloney. Dundee, well, they still elected Churchill. But this goes to show that the suffragettes were focusing on Scotland in particular because you had some really big politicians up here. And what were they all worrying about? Well, I just want to show you two postcards that were produced at the time about the way that anti-suffragists thought of women. Yeah! So the one on the left shows us what we are all thinking about, of course. I know that you're sitting there not really listening to me because you're thinking about chocolate that you're going to share with your dog while you look for a husband, write letters, wear a lovely dress and look for your new hat. Of course, that's all that goes on in the head, so there's no room whatsoever for politics. And those who do want the vote, well, quite clearly, we all look like the one on the right. It was a great belief that those who wanted the vote were actually women who'd never been kissed before. And the reason they decided they wanted the vote is because if they went out and campaigned for it, then they would get a policeman's arms around them. Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. But suffice it to say, there were many more women who wanted the vote, who delighted in postcards like these and would often use them to write cryptic postcard messages on the back and send them. Glasgow Women's Library have got a fantastic collection of postcards and I thoroughly recommend you have a look at them. And one of the things I'm hoping to do soon is have a look at the messages on the back and see if we can interpret any of them. Back here in Edinburgh, on the 9th of October 1909, there was a great big march, a procession down at Prince's Street, led by Flora Drummond, who was sometimes called General Flora Drummond. She was a very small wee woman, but feisty, brought up on the Isle of Arran. She loved to dress in military uniform, and at this particular procession, she was right at the front, sitting astride, the horror, a white horse, leading all the women from all the classes and the industries through the streets. They marched from Brunsfield Links, down Lothian Road, and along Prince's Street. 1909 was quite a pivotal year in many ways, because earlier that year, on the 24th of June 1909, the lady on the left, Marion Wallace Dunlop, originally from Scotland, down in London, she had gone into St Stephen's Hall in Westminster, and she managed to stencil an extract for the Bill of Rights, which stated it is the right of the subjects to petition the king, and all commitments and prosecutions for such petitioning are illegal. You can imagine this didn't go down too well, so she got arrested, put in prison, and this is the very first time a woman suffragette prisoner went on hunger strike. It was not told on high, it was not something that the Pankhursts thought up. Marion decided to do it all on her own, and as the newspaper states, she was only in for 91 hours before she started to become rather unwell, and the prisoners went, okay, well, there we go, you can leave. When the Pankhursts heard about this, I thought, ooh, that's quite a good idea. And this is when hunger strike started. To such an extent that on the 24th of September 1909, so only a few months later, the government, so fed up of releasing those on hunger strike, decided to force feed them. I won't go into details here, but if you do go down into the exhibition, I would recommend you don't go down having just eaten, because there are some particular details down there and you'll get to understand how horrific it was. And let's just say that there are different ways to get to the stomach. well, two in particular, and the government made use of both ways. But then in 1910, the government decides that they are going to set up a cross-party committee and they're going to look at what they called the Conciliation Bill. This is looking at suffrage for adults, not just for women, but also for the men who still couldn't vote. And the WSPU decided, okay, while you're doing that, we'll call a truce. We won't go out and we won't smash things up. But in November of that year, on the 22nd of November, the government announces that Parliament's going to be dissolved because they want to call another election, and therefore there is no time to debate the Conciliation Bill. The WSPU march on Westminster, and it's gone down in history as called Black Friday, the 22nd of November 1910. Mass brutality, and not just physical brutality, but sexual brutality as well. No one died on the day, but two women died shortly after, and many received horrific injuries. And this is the background of the 1911 census. This is November 1910. At the beginning of 1911, there's another truce is called because the government has been reformed. Liberals are back in power, but with slightly less majority. They had called a snap election, firmly believing that it would increase their majority, but it didn't. It decreased their majority. And imagine if that happened today. I mean, oh, crazy idea. This is the background to the 1911 census. So they were hoping that a conciliation bill would come through. And for a moment, I just want us to look at that census in particular. Since 1801, censuses have been held in the UK every 10 years. I don't know if you remember, but 2011 was the last time we had a census. And the results from that showed so many people in this country are Jedis, and there was all sorts of different religions that were coming out of that. Well, since 1801, the same basic questions have been asked, but a few have been added year on year. And in 1911, they were going to ask two extra bits of information in particular. They wanted a special inquiry into marriage and fertility. One of the biggest concerns for some group of men at the time was about whether the poorer classes were having more children than the higher classes. Those who were most concerned about this believed that it was leading to a genetic decline in Britain. Essentially, they believed that the lower classes were poor and sick because of their bad genes. Nothing to do with housing or lack of facilities or anything to do with that. And therefore, if they improved public health, the poor would live for longer, they would breed more, and they would be poor and sickly. And they would outbreed the more intelligent middle classes. Evidence was needed to prove or disprove this. A 1903 lecture stated, "The mentally better stock in the nation is not reproducing itself at the same rate as it did of old. The less able and the less energetic are more fertile than the better stocks. The only remedy, if one be possible at all, is to alter the relative fertility of the good and the bad stocks in the community." And that's why these questions were introduced to the 1911 census. Each married woman was asked the total number of children that were born alive, the number of children still living, the number of children who died, and how long the marriage had been. There was also a degree to see to which fertility was affected when women worked and what types of employment. So the box on the bottom here, this is all about profession and occupation. And it's trying to see whether those who work in particular occupations have more children or have more children who die and the correlations between the two. It's also important to see the 1911 census in the context of what the ruling government at the time were hoping to achieve. The Liberal government had been in power for over 5 years, and this was a government that had pushed through the People's Budget of 1909, despite massive opposition from the House of Lords. This budget saw the introduction of old age pensions and national insurance. Census data would help to shape future welfare reforms. And yet, this was a government that still refused to recognise women as people. So the idea of the boycott came about. Now, the idea of the boycott actually came from the Women's Freedom League, WFL, and they came up with this idea as early as June 1910. Mrs. Despard, Charlotte Despard, who had set up the WFL, she had actually met Gandhi when he had come across to London. Gandhi, of course, this great idea of spiritual resistance to unjust laws. This was exactly the kind of thing that he would have been interested in. So they decided, June 1910, that they would propose a census boycott, but we'll wait and see what the government does. The immediate trigger for the census boycott happened on the 6th of February 1911. The King's speech opening the new Parliament was read in the House of Commons and made no mention whatsoever of women's suffrage. So the WFL wasted no time in putting its plans into action. The vote was their newspaper that they published, and this edition is on the 11th of February, so only 5 days later, and at the very top of the front cover you can see it says, "Boycott the census." Inside, there's an article that goes on to say, any government which refuses to recognise women must be met by women's refusal to recognise the government, and calls upon women all over the kingdom to boycott the census. We intend to do our best to make it unreliable and inaccurate. As soon as the WFL's proposed boycott went public, the WSPU went, oh, that's a brilliant idea, and decided to join the protest as well. This article on the left is from the paper that the WSPU published called called Votes for Women. This was published on the 24th of February, and it outlines ways that you can basically boycott the census. The article on the right is taken from the Dundee Courier, which also helpfully outlined ways that you could boycott the census. So you could, if you like, fill your house with evaders. Lend your house to the WSPU and ask no questions as to who will occupy it on a Sunday night. Leave the house empty and write across the schedule, house deserted by women who want the vote. This is in a paper that you could go in and buy that anyone could read. So this idea of boycotting the census was across all of the press in Scotland and down in England. Emmeline Pankhurst wrote a letter to the Times, who was very anti-boycotting the census. Pankhurst stated, "The census is a numbering of the people. Until women count as people for the purpose of representation in the councils of the nation, we shall refuse to be numbered." 2 years before this, there had been another society set up against taxation. The Women's Tax Resistance League, WTRL, and their idea was no taxation without representation, and that idea was taken on by this census boycott. The WFL even produced a leaflet called Women in the Census, and they sent it all around, stating, "This year, special intimate questions relating to women as mothers have been added. Refuse to assist a government which denies you citizenship. Withhold the information which helps make laws which govern you without your consent." So what happened up here in Scotland? The first thing to say about the census up here in Scotland, in terms of the records that we now have, unfortunately, the original household returns, which you may well have seen in papers when they were talking about the suffragette census boycott, no longer exist up here in Scotland. They were destroyed many years ago. I am actually working on a time machine, so I will go back and rescue them from the fires. But for now, we don't have them. But we do have the enumerator returns, so we have information written up like that. We have an incredible collection here at the National Records of letters that were written by enumerators to the Registrar General, and I will show you some of those. And I definitely recommend you go to the exhibition, because a couple are on display, and there are also transcripts down there of some of them as well. And huge thanks to Veronica for transcribing many of them. It's very tightly bound. You'll see when you go down there, it's incredibly hard to do. And there were also lots of newspaper reports as well. Letters were written like this one. This is a letter written to the Registrar General saying that Dr. Grace Cadell from 145 Leith Walk, Leith, has refused to fill up the schedule. She's basically said, no, I am doing this as a protest, and refused to fill it out. This is the only clue that we have, that she refused to fill it out. And the reason I've particularly highlighted her is because she was an incredible woman who she was one of the first students in the first intake at the Edinburgh School of Medicine for Women, which had been established by Sophia Jex Black. And lectures there were taught, and you had to be out of the school by 5 o'clock. One day, Grace and her sister and a couple of other people wanted to stay behind to make sure a patient was all right. And because of that, Sophia Jex Black banished them from the school. So she and Eliza set up a new school and carried on and became a doctor. And she's particularly important for the suffragette story because when, in a couple of years' time, the Cat and Mouse Act is introduced in 1913, which means those on hunger strike are released on licence to get better and then, of course, come back to prison. Hi, I'm better now. Can I come back to prison? I write. She would look after them and nurse them back to health. And it's brilliant that she decided to protest. She had also refused to pay her taxes a little while earlier as well, and some of her goods had been seized and sold by auction. So what I've been doing, as well as looking at the letters, I'm going through the census records, page by page, looking for anything which indicates there may or may not have been a suffragette. And I'm going to show you somewhat of what I found today. So let's think about mass evasions. And to do this, I want us to stay in Edinburgh, but just go down the road to Nicholson Street. On Nicholson Street was a cafe called Cafe Vegetaria. Apologies for the quality of the printout here, but Cafe Vegetaria was used by the WSPU on the night of the census. They hired it for the night. And, well, there are no names because, of course, they refused to fill out the census. But what we do have, and I don't know if you can see here, we've just got a line. This is where the ages go. So that line there, they're all men at the moment. But there's actually 6 pages of this, of just ages. Men and women. And that's all we've got. How did they get the ages? Well, they had the police standing opposite the cafe. I'll read to you from the Edinburgh Evening News. From 6 o'clock this morning, the ladies commenced to leave their haven, and up until about 8 o'clock, between 50 and 60 had taken their departure from the cafe. Opposite the cafe were 2 detectives in the mouth of a common stair on duty, enumerating as the suffragettes made their appearance. They estimated that about as many again would be in the premises till about midday, and quite a number entered the cafe during the morning, making the work of the officers more difficult. Oh, poor them. Basically, all they did was, I reckon she's about 25, write that down. Yeah, 45. Oh, he's 50. 17. They were just guessing the ages. 6 pages of nothing but guesstimate of ages. It is incredible. There was an awful lot that was in the papers about what went on. And I just want to share a little bit with you. So we had the keys of the cafe in the possession of the suffragists. See, the term suffragists and suffragettes, today we know what we mean, but it was very intertwined back in those days. So they called them suffragists, but they were what we understand as suffragettes. Many were in the premises early in the day, but during the evening, when the protesters were expected to arrive, a large crowd of the vote-monopolising sex... And I see there's a few here, as you vote-monopolising sex here. Love that phrase. Gathered around the entrance to the building to hoot and jeer at the women as they passed in. At first, the women had some difficulty in penetrating through the crowd, but later the 4 uniformed police kept the bystanders back to the curbside. At 12 o'clock, the last of the protesters having arrived, there was a gay crowd of 100 or so assembled in the rooms of the cafe, and a buzz of preparations going forward for the entertainment. Half of the large room was cut up by improvised curtains, behind which living waxworks were being set up and disguises were being assumed. Friends were unrecognisable behind their false noses and wigs. And I love the idea that they had a night of being in a cafe and they wore disguises and they pretended to be other people and they put on shows for each other. That is essentially what they did. So you've got the detectives watching, you've got the waxwork shows. So the waxwork shows opened at 12:30 that night, continued till about 2 o'clock in the morning. As all the waxworks were continuously on view, it was no small strain on the patient endurance of the actors. And the living dolls were grouped in three sections: romantic, political, and domestic. So you've got three types of waxworks, and imagine standing there for an hour and a half, like not moving at all. It's incredible. And then after the waxwork show, they had singing and laughing. And then, of course, they descended for tea and coffee and buns. Good. And then such as wished to rest retired to the upper rooms to sleep. So these are over 100 women who go to a cafe to dress up, stand still for an hour and a half, sing, eat buns, have a cup of tea and have a sleepover. This is what the census boycott for these women was all about. And I love it. The Lucy Burns who hired the WSPU, she was an American who had come across round about 1909, and in 1911 she was the WSPU's organiser of the Edinburgh branch. As far as I can tell, this is the largest mass evasion that happened in Scotland. Certainly over six pages worth, it is a mass evasion. I haven't been able to find anything on this scale in Glasgow or Dundee or the like. But other things did happen. The WSPU was very much at Cafe Vegetaria. WFL, the Freedom League, decided to be elsewhere. So they went to houses. And again, you'll see a recurring theme here, dressing up. Essentially, the census boycott is an excuse to dress up with your friends and put on. I have to say, that mask there creeps me out a little bit. And I'm loving that false nose. At least I hope it is false. This is an incredible photograph. The National Library of Scotland have a photographic album from Ellen Gorey, who was involved in the WSPU, and this was a photograph in the photographic album. During the 1909 procession down Princes Street, she got to dress up as Mary Queen of Scots, which is kind of one of the top jobs to have, and it's fantastic. So there are lots of people in Edinburgh dressing up and hiding. Elsewhere in the country, things happened as well, though. Let us go to Dundee. And we actually have a photograph from the Dundee Courier of some of the women who took part in this protest. We also have a letter to the Registrar General telling us what happened that night. At 10 p.m, Tom Rogers, photographer for the Courier, took a photo of five of them, which appeared in the Courier on Monday last. At 10:45 p.m, another two entered, and at 11 p.m, another three entered, making 10 in all, and none of them left up to 12 midnight. At 3:50 a.m, four came out and extinguished the lights, and they proceeded by way of Lindsay Street and Ward Road to the suffragette offices in the latter street, but which had not been lighted up to then. The offices in Nethergate were lighted up, and two flags of the suffragette colours were waving from the centre window, while the front was billed, "No census, no votes." And at the bottom, this is the census return for that property in Nethergate. And it's a bit tricky to see because of the quality, but you've got one lady here. She is Daisy Isabella Frances Smith. I haven't been able to find out much about her at the moment, but she is down as the head. She's 25 years old, and she is the organiser of the WSPU. Was that her real name? We don't know. But what I find particularly interesting about this census return, there's always a column that records the relationship of the person to the head of that household. All the other ladies, all nine ladies, their relationship is as inmate. So they are put down as inmate, which I think says something about the attitude of the enumerator and what he thought of these pesky women wanting the vote. Other women decided to stay away from home. And we have here a letter to the Registrar General that's reporting seven visitors, five females and two males. And I think it's really important to note that males were involved in this as well. Those who believe that women should be given the suffrage were definitely there supporting them. Seven females and two males have not been included in the enumeration on account of refusing to give up the information and evading the enumerator by living in a wooden erection on Sunday evening. Mind boggles, I have to say, at that particular bit. But the registrar here has done his best to try and work out who they are and where they should be counted. And this is the important bit. They were evading the census so they weren't counted, but he knows how many there were, so they are going to be counted after all. Enumerators can be really useful for historians like me to shed a little bit more light when protests were being made. This is one that I discovered just last week. It's in Cathcart in Glasgow. And at the bottom, he's written, so this is a enumeration return. So the enumerators would put down all the household schedules onto a big return, and this is the end of it. But then in the red handwriting, he's put, Miss Anna Little, 77 Albert Drive, Cross Hill, and three sisters and a visitor, Miss Munro, and probably other guests were in the house named on census night and refused to give information. Which is brilliant for me when I'm trying to find out about the protest, but 100 years ago, when they were not wanting to be counted, that's a wee bit frustrating because he knows how many people roughly there were. So we've talked about mass evasion and protests, but what about people who weren't on their usual at their usual home on the night of the census? For example, in West Kilbride, a letter is written to the Registrar General saying, the enumerator reports to me that when he called on Mrs. Ince Milwellan Jenkins for the delivery of the schedule, he found the schedule fastened to the front door of her house and no one in it. The schedule has written across the face of it the words, left home in order to evade the census. So she had read that article in the Dundee Courier. She knew what she was doing. And the enumerator, when he's then filling out his big book, recording all the households, has actually put that on the census return, which is fantastic. Although, particularly his filled-in schedule, which was forwarded on outside, he was able still to get some information. Although I do like the fact that when he went and he met up with her and saying, why haven't you filled it in? In reply to my queries as to where she had been and if she had been enumerated elsewhere, she stated she had no responsibility for any other house than her own and would not give me further information. She produced to me a copy of the publication Votes for Women by the advice in which she said she was going. I like that. Here, have this, read it. This is what I'm doing. But by its very nature, deciding whether someone was away from their home to evade the census or just happened to be elsewhere at the time can be very tricky. For example, on the Isle of Skye, a woman was staying in the Sleachan Inn. So down here, right at the very bottom, we have a lady, Margaret Stewart Tate. She's a visitor. Interestingly, she is the only visitor at the inn on that night. We know her name, and that's presumably from the innkeeper filling in her name from the registrar. He's given a rough guesstimate. He reckons she's about 45, but all other information has been deleted. Not known, not known, not known. And their letter supports this. One of the visitors, a lady at the Sleachan Hotel, refused to give any particulars regarding herself either to the hotel proprietor or the enumerator for the district. She has been a visitor to the hotel for several years and is well known to the proprietor by name. Now, I don't know about you, if I'm evading the census, I think I would probably choose somewhere that I'd never been before, that they didn't know me. So I can't decide whether she was just genuinely on holiday and decided, spur of the moment, not to say anything, or whether she went on holiday to not be at home on the night of the census, but forgot that they knew her name. I can't quite decide that. We don't know anything else about her at the moment. I want us to go back to Dundee for a minute and show you this wonderful photo, this wonderful drawing of a lady called Ethel Moorhead. She became one of the most famous Scottish suffragettes in the press. In fact, they often named her the leader of the Scottish suffragettes. You can find out more about her in the exhibition downstairs. She became most famous because in Scotland, we didn't force feed prisoners until February 1914. So 1909, they started down in England. February 1914, we started here in Scotland. Ethel has the delight, is the wrong word, but she is the person who was force-fed first here in Scotland. But back in 1911, she's living at home with her father and she refuses to fill out the census return. She claims that she is the head of the household, not her father. She's the one who's paying the rent. So she is the one that has the responsibility for filling the census and she doesn't want to do it. So an enumerator goes round to talk to the father thinking, oh, he'll be able to give me the information. Let me just read you my favourite bit from, there are two letters written to the Registrar General about this. So the enumerator's gone in and he's talking to Mr. Moorhead, and while I had just read the first paragraph of your letter, Miss Moorhead, his daughter, whose refusal to fill up a census schedule I've already reported to you, came hastily into the room, challenged my right to enter her home without first obtaining her authority, and commanded me to leave at once, at the same time declaring that no information would be given to me. I begged her not to interfere with me in the performance of my duty and told her I would listen only to her father and that I would go whenever he asked me. Then she ran off to another room and almost instantly returned with a large brass bell, which she kept constantly clanging to drown my voice while I was endeavouring to make myself heard to her father. Now, she was from Dundee, and I would love to think that she was around when Belle Maloney, Mary Maloney, was doing her bell with Churchill, and she thought, oh, that's a brilliant idea. So to be a suffragette, you need to have a bell with you at all times. You never know. In fact, try it in your life. It might improve things. And at the bottom, you can see that we've got Ethel Moorhead down there, probably about 36. Interesting, the father doesn't even know how old his daughter is. And a lot of it is unknown and unknown. Even the servants, she's not giving any information up at all. So far, I've discovered that the majority of those who evaded the census or protested against it were in Dundee, Glasgow and Edinburgh. But I just want to show you one that we know of in Argyll and Bute in Glenmore. So just under the first entrance there for Hector MacPhail, underneath that, we have four females. We know they're females because the enumerator is very helpfully written in the female line there, but information refused. But he still knew that there were four there, so he still counted four. Going back to Glasgow, at the very bottom here, we have Janet Barrowman. At least we think it's Janet Barrowman. Janet Barrowman is particularly important for Glasgow Life because in 1955, she arranged to donate a number of suffragette items to Glasgow Life that are currently on display at the People's Palace, and they have a whole lot of other items as well. Unfortunately, the majority of them were given with no context, so we don't know who they came from, but one of the things that was given to them was a badge, No Census, No Vote, a census resistance badge that were given out. We don't know where it came from, whether it was hers or someone else's, but I love the fact that we've been able to find her, and just in fairly faint blue writing on the left-hand side, just so we know why we don't have the full name suffragette. So this is really interesting to me because this is a schedule of a household. Janet doesn't put her first name down, but nor does her mum. Her mum backs her in this. So it's no, that's absolutely fine. And it's always really interesting to me seeing those who protested and the support they had around them. Another person in Glasgow, and we know that she's a suffragette. So we have just here, we've got Margaret Gibb and two females and a male, two servants and a daughter. Now, this Margaret Gibb is, we believe, the Margaret Gibb who set up the Glasgow Ladies Chess Club in 1905. And we think, we hope anyway, that that's one of her daughters. She had a couple of daughters who was very active as suffragettes, one of whom actually went down to London and chopped in the National Gallery, National Portrait Gallery, rather, chopped out a Thomas Carlyle portrait. I'm hoping that's her. If not, it's her sister. Either way, it's one of the daughters who was very much into suffragettes. So we've got one name there, Margaret Gibb. We've got some ages, but across here we've got suffragette information refused. Now, this is quite frustrating for me in that there's no rhyme or reason as to where the numerators are writing suffragette. So you have to look all over the place. Some write it on the left, some write it on the right, some write it at the very end of the returns. There's no rhyme or reason. This is why I'm having to go through every single return very carefully. And sometimes you're wondering whether you're making someone be a suffragette. For example, at the bottom of this enumeration return, it just says absent on night of census. Now, there could be any number of reasons for that. But my mind, of course, immediately goes, oh, were they a suffragette? I don't know. And this is where it is really, really tricky. But we do have two original household returns that have been preserved, one of which is on display down in the exhibition. This one here. They're preserved along with the other letters that have been written to the Registrar General, and they're preserved in a very tightly bound volume, which is why it's quite tricky to be able to see all of it. But you can see at the very top here, Miss M.F. Thompson has written, "No vote for women, no information from women." Quite right too. And another one, "I refuse all information until I get the parliamentary franchise." Mary Angus, she signed it, which is lovely. So we know her name and we should know that she lived in Dundee. But other than that, she's put no information whatsoever. Now, I could speak for quite a long time, but time is coming to a close. So I just want to mention one more way that women could use the census. And so far in Scotland, I've only found one example of this. This is the census return for East Lothian, and I know at least one person will recognise it. This is an amazing woman called Catherine Blair. She lived on Hopebriggs Farm in East Lothian. And on the night of the census, she decided to leave the farmhouse to take with her two daughters and a servant and go and stay in a barn. That way, she is the head of the household. She gets to fill in the return. She hasn't protested. She hasn't evaded. She is there. She is filling it out. But I just want to draw your attention to her occupation. Farmer's wife, in brackets, suffragette. I know in England there were a few women who put suffragette down as their occupation. So far in Scotland, Catherine Blair is the only one that I found that has put their occupation down as suffragette. This doesn't mean that she was being paid by the WSPU at all, but this is her way of highlighting that she is a suffragette, and it shows how important it was to her. And this is Catherine. She was an incredible woman. She hid suffragettes when they were released under the Cat and Mouse Act. She hid them on the farm. And she wrote letters. She wrote so many letters. One of her letters she wrote to the doctor who force-fed Ethel Moorhead. He received quite a few letters when he first force-fed Ethel Moorhead. Some of those letters are on display down in the exhibition. And you'll see Catherine held no punches at all. She didn't hold back. She said it like it was. The photograph on the right I'm showing because Catherine Blair went on to start the Scottish Women's Rural Institute in 1917, and it's in that role that she met the Queen Mother. So we have different ways that women were using the census. But was it successful, this boycott? Well, at the time, it depended who you asked. Amongst those who supported the boycott, it was, of course, deemed a success! Yay! Lawrence Houseman, a great supporter of the suffrage movement, who set up in 1907 the Men's League for Women's Suffrage down in London, stated in his autobiography, "The census resistance of 1911 was one of the very few things in the way of militancy which the women suffragists did on so large a scale that the government was unable to touch them. In a very short time, the idea caught on, even among the constitutionals." Lie. "It found a certain amount of favour, especially perhaps when the size of the demonstration made legal penalties less likely." On the other hand, one of the politicians, when he was asked about it in the Commons, 2 days after the census had been taken, stated, "I do not anticipate that the suffragette agitation against the census will have any appreciable effect upon the accuracy of the statistics of population," and added further, "According to the information that has reached me up to present, the number of individuals we have evaded being enumerated is altogether negligible." So what was the reality? When discussing the boycott of the census, it is important to bear in mind that this was supported by the WSPU and the WFL, not the NUWSS, not the constitutional suffragists. This was against the law, this was breaking the law, and that's not what they did. And that's important because the NUWSS had by far the greatest support. In 1910, they had over 20,000 members, much more than the WSPU and the WFL. Any boycott was not going to be huge in scale anyway. And even those who did evade, who did protest, as we have seen, they managed to be counted. So if the idea of the boycott was to avoid being counted, then unfortunately, the majority of them failed in that. However, what is important is to see that in terms of press coverage, the boycott was a success due to the amount of press coverage it received, which made sure that the public's attention was again brought to the injustices of the British voting system and the state of women's rights. And one little note to end on. 100 years after this boycott in 2011, when that census was being taken, the person in charge of all of that was a woman. So 100 years after the boycott of the census, a woman was in charge of the census. Thank you very much. This podcast was produced for National Records of Scotland by Ross Truslove. It is copyright of National Records of Scotland and all rights are reserved.